Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Germany celebrates the anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down, and the U.S. and Iran in the P5 are talking about Iran's nuclear programs. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Germans are celebrating the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, with Chancellor Angela Merkel praising the people who helped bring it down. The day's ceremonies in the German capital began with a trumpet call evoking the trumpets, the Bible says, brought down the walls of Jericho. Chancellor Merkel today placed a rose on one of the few remaining sections of the wall, commemorating those who died trying to escape to the West. Ms. Merkel said the wall was a symbol of state abuse cast in concrete that took millions of people to the limits of what is tolerable. The Berlin Wall divided the German capital and came to define the Cold War, which pitted the U.S. and its allies against the Soviet Union following World War II. Secretary of State John Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif are in face-to-face talks in Amman with just 2 weeks until the deadline for reaching a nuclear deal. European Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton is also there, speaking before departing Beijing on Saturday. Secretary Kerry.
There is no linkage whatsoever of the nuclear discussions with any other issue. And I want to make that absolutely clear.
President Obama said last week that the U.S. and P5 plus one allies have given Iran a framework for a nuclear agreement. Yemen's Shiite rebels are rejecting the new cabinet put together by President Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi, raising doubts about the chances of ending the country's turmoil. The rebels, known as Houthis, say Mr. Hadi's cabinet choices violate a peace agreement signed in September and place private interests over the political process. They called for an immediate reshuffling but did not spell out what they'll do if the president refuses their demand. This is VOA News. A Britain-based watchdog says Syria launched an airstrike on a northern town, killing 21 people, wounding 100 more. The bombs, barrel bombs, were dropped Saturday on Al-Bab. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, with Al-Bab being a stronghold of the Islamic State, barrel bombs are made by packing explosives into canisters or oil drums and topping it off with fuel and metal shards. Since the start of the U.S. airstrikes against the Islamic State, rebel commanders have warned that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad would view American intervention as license to increase his attacks against opposition. Two Americans freed by North Korea have arrived home safely today in the U.S. Both Kenneth Bay and Matthew Todd Miller were serving lengthy sentences when U.S. National Intelligence Director James Clapper went to North Korea to gain their freedom. Bay was in detention since 2012 on a conviction of anti-government activities while leading a group of tourists. Miller was in prison since April for tearing up his tourist visa in the Pyongyang airport and demanding asylum. China's President Xi Jinping says that while China's economy faces challenges, they aren't as scary as some may think. VOA's Bill Ide reports from Beijing.
President Xi Jinping says that as China adapts to what he calls a new normal of slower growth and slacking exports, the country's growth rate is still ranked as one of the highest in the world. Mr. Xi says some people worry that China's economy will fall further. He says there are indeed risks. China's economy is now at the lowest point since the 2008-2009 global financial crisis. Mr. Xi's remarks came at the opening ceremony of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation CEO Leaders Summit. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
A suicide bomber has killed a senior aide to the police chief of the Afghan capital in Kabul. Authorities say the Taliban bomber, wearing a police uniform, walked into police headquarters today, detonating his explosives, killing an aide and wounding at least six others. The police chief was not harmed in the attack. Ukraine's separatist bastion of Donetsk came under intense military artillery fire today, increasing strains on a two-month-old ceasefire deal between the Ukrainian government forces and pro-Russian separatists. European monitors in Ukraine say they're very concerned after seeing convoys of heavy weapons and tanks in the region. The OSCE chairperson in office, Swiss President and Foreign Minister Didier Burkhalter, says he is worried about a resurgence of violence and urged all sides Saturday to do all in their power to further consolidate the ceasefire in effect there and stay away from acts that could lead to a new escalation. Also today, the U.S. Attorney General, the newly nominated New York federal prosecutor, has been asked to join the cabinet. That would be Loretta Lynch, who was named Saturday. President Obama said he can think of no better public servant for the job. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
They're still waiting for the political opposition and the army to reach an agreement, and they're about to reach it out.
In Burkina Faso, negotiations are underway to form a civilian-led transitional government. We'll have details.
We have since engaged them, and they're ready to support us. But so far, we've done what we could in our own capacity.
The Zambia Elections Commission begins preparations to organize fresh presidential election to replace deceased President Michael Sata.
It's a kind of challenging. When you wake up in the morning, you start to brush your teeth, organizing, going for work. What comes into your mind is, how am I going to get to the place of work?
And fuel shortage hits Africa's newest oil-producing nation, South Sudan. We'll have details. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Opposition and civil society groups are negotiating with Burkina Faso's military to form a civilian-led transition government. This after protesters forced longtime President Blaise Compaoré to step down and flee into exile. For more on the current situation, I reached Issa Napong, a reporter and news anchor at Burkina Faso's National Radio and Television. He says opposition and civil society groups are sharply against a military official leading the yet-to-be-established transitional administration.
They're still waiting for the political opposition and the army to reach an agreement, and they're about to reach it out because the army has worked on a kind of roadmap and sent it to the opposition to make some amendments. But what happens is that in some points of the roadmap, the military said they will appoint someone to lead the transition, which must be composed of 15 members of some political formations, 15 members representing the army and law enforcement, and 15 members from the civil society. But now the political opposition denied they're willing to do so. They said in the amended document that the temporary president must be a civilian, you know, civilian and never a member of the army of law enforcement.
The opposition do not want any member of the current military class to be part of the transition government. Is that the case?
They will be part of the transition, but they don't want any military or law enforcement person to lead the transition. That's what they said.
So what is the opposition currently doing now? Because ECOWAS is saying that there should not be sanctions imposed on Burkina Faso. What is the opposition doing now since they have not agreed?
They have agreed on 2 points. They know that they agreed on the principle of bringing back the constitution and notice the government and parliament vacancies which were pronounced by the overthrown president. But now they work with the UA commissioners and international community and accepted that they can't put us on under sanction because we have a history and we have some values. We have to talk together and agree on some point before designing someone who could lead the transition.
Napon, when are they agreeing to name the transitional government?
There's no date for that because they're still working on the roadmap. And that's what I said. We received a copy of what the political opposition and the civil society agreed on, and they have to send it to the army now before something will come out lately. because they said that the College of Physicians, like I said, must contain 45 members. And they stand for a government of 25 members to a special parliament of 90 people equally divided between the political parties and civil society. And they also ask for to set a national commission for reconciliation and reforms in order to strengthen the social cohesion with several subcommittees for trials, justice and reconciliation and so forth. But what's going on now is that we have to wait for the army to receive the official amended roadmap and then they will work on it again, and together they will come up with a document which can be in everybody's interest and the national interest too.
Issa Napon is a reporter and news anchor at Burkina Faso's National Radio and Television. He spoke with me from the capital, Ouagadougou. African leaders are scheduled to arrive in Zambia on Monday, a day ahead of Tuesday's burial of the country's deceased President Michael Sata. Earlier today, I reached Billy Kazoka, news editor at Radio Phoenix, a major independent station in the Zambian capital, Lusaka, who says a lot of Zambians are paying their last respect to the fallen head of state.
The current situation actually is that a lot of Zambians are lined up on the Mulungushi International Conference Center where the body for the late president is lying in state. Early in the morning, I was among those that did pay their last respect at the beginning of the day this morning. And there were so many people. I was hoping that I was going to be the first one, but I found there was so shocking that there were so many multitudes and multitudes of people. I don't know, maybe it was because it's the last day.
So today is the last day for the public to pay their respect to the deceased president?
Yes, today is the last day for the public to pay their last respect to the deceased president. And tomorrow they are going to move the body of the late president to Parliament buildings. Thereafter they will take it to State House where it will lay in state ahead of the burial the following day, which is Tuesday.
What about the heads of state and government officials who have confirmed their participation in the funeral ceremonies of the late president?
Yes, according to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the presidents that are coming, that have confirmed that they are coming to Lusaka, is Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. The President of Malawi is going to send his vice. They have just issued a statement that he's not coming, he's sending his vice. Also, the President of South Africa is sending his vice. And Queen Elizabeth is also sending somebody from the royal family who is going to represent her. And also the president of DRC, Joseph Kabila, is also confirmed the attendance of the burial.
When are they expected to arrive in Zambia ahead of Tuesday's burial?
According to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, tomorrow they are starting to arrive, while others are going to arrive on the same day. But we are not too sure who are arriving tomorrow and who are coming on the same day.
There was an issue where the government temporarily suspended the viewing of the public. What happened?
Apparently, there was no explanation as to why they did that. It is confirmed, yes, they did suspend the paying of last respects. That was yesterday, Saturday. I think they expected the cabinet had issued a statement to say that body viewing will be temporarily suspended. But in his statement, there was no explanation as to why they decided to do so.
Zahakainda Hichilema, the main opposition leader, has called for unity as the country grieves and readies to bury the deceased president. Is this being adhered to by everybody in Zambia?
It is actually very surprising that the opposition leader is among those in the forefront urging unity. I mean, we should know that, in fact, a couple of days ago he has issued another statement where he was urging the leaders of the ruling party to show responsibility and ensure that the country remains united and ensure that we mourn our departed president in dignity. And actually that was very, very surprising, because one would have thought that him being an opposition leader was not going to be in a position to issue such a statement. But he has been very consistent in that regard. Even today he issued a similar statement urging Zambians to mourn the late president in dignity and remain united.
Former Defense Minister Godfred Mwamba has said he has reconciled with President Sata before his death. Is he part of the ceremony? Because there appear to be very intense rivalry accusations and counter-accusations when he left cabinet. Has that been resolved?
The former defense minister, he had announced that he had reconciled the former president when Winter Kabimba, the former Secretary General of the Patriotic Front, was dismissed. That's when he came out in the open to say that I've reconciled with the former president. And looking at the current situation, just a few weeks before the president died, we had parliamentary by-elections, and he campaigned alongside the head of state in those by-elections.
Billy Kazoka is the news editor at Radio Phoenix, a major independent station. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Meanwhile, the Electoral Commission of Zambia has begun preparations to organize a presidential election to replace Michael Sata. The constitution enables the electoral body to administer a new vote within 90 days after the death of a certain president. The election is now scheduled to be held in January to meet demands of the constitution. Chomba Chela, the deputy director for elections, told me that the electoral body is ready to administer a credible presidential vote.
We have a mandate by the constitution. When there's a vacancy that falls at presidential or is it national assembly, we need to start working. And so far, we've done everything that we could. It's only that I think people should also bear with us that culturally we have to have. What we call a national mourning, and it was declared by the acting president of the republic when we lost the president, that we go up to the 11th of November to mourn the president. Then thereof, then we will obviously work within the 90 days. And the 90 days from the time the sitting president died falls on the 26th of January. So we have to hold elections before that.
Will you be ready and will the Electoral Commission be prepared and adequately funded ahead of this election?
No, certainly. And because it's a constitutional requirement where it stipulates that within 90 days of the seat of the presidency fully vacant, we have to prepare and we need to have election done. From Electoral Commission point of view, we've already done what we can within our mandate to prepare for it. But we also have to work through the Treasury, because we get finance through the Treasury, which is the Ministry of Finance, to give us the money. And we have since engaged them, and they're ready to support us. But so far, we've done what we could in our own capacity to ensure that the election is well prepared.
Mr. Chela, wouldn't you have time constraints, especially when you have always enjoyed enough time? Wouldn't you be constrained by the time frame to organize fresh presidential election?
And I think for us, I think we've learned our lessons from 2008 elections when the incumbent then, Levy Mwanawasa, died. And I think from then we learned our lessons and we were able to draw our lessons from then. And so far, I think we're okay. And we're on course and very, very, very confident that we will do it properly. Because then, I think in 2008, it happened at the time when we needed, interpretation to the law. And then I think the interpretation to the law was given very adequately. So I think benefit, but it's only that we've drawn lessons from a sitting president dying. So we've learned our lessons from 2008, and I think we've learned good lessons which will help us build up from there. And over and above that, we will sit down and we think an election happened in 2011, we already prepared for 2016. So our lessons were learned from 2008. And over and above that, we're already preparing for 2016, And 2016 meant, let me just show you that. Elections is not an event. It's a process. Elections, we have a pre-election period, election period, and post-election period. So we've learned our lessons. One, going from a 2008 election, a snap election, when a president dies in office. Over and above that, even when we conducted our tripartite election in 2011, we've been going through all sorts of processes of the electoral process.
Chomba Chela is the Deputy Director for the Electoral Commission of Zambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. And there is growing chaos in Libya. According to local media, the internationally recognized government has been driven out of the capital, and in the main eastern city of Benghazi, 5 pro-government soldiers were killed and 28 wounded on Saturday. Mansour El-Kikia is a Libyan-American author and professor of political science at the University of Texas, San Antonio. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him there and asked him whether he was concerned by the current situation in Libya.
Of course I am. Libya is undergoing very, very violent changes. And this is really the result of so many years of lawlessness, so many years. Even in Gaddafi, there was no law. And so people have really forgot the idea of what law looks like. And when he left, of course, then they reverted to what they know best. 40 years is a long time. It changes a whole generation. Of course, I'm very, very worried about Libya.
You mentioned there was no law under President Gaddafi. But at least then there was a sense of a central control of the whole country. Now, with the country falling into various factions, what does that all go well for the country?
No, of course, it doesn't go well for the country. But you understand, this is the result of any dictatorship. You're going to see this happening. It doesn't matter whether it's in Libya, whether it was in Zaire at one time, whether it's Liberia. That's what happens. Dictatorships do breed this type of systems. What we're seeing today is just how well is the society able to adapt and adopt to these insecurities. In the case of Libya today, you know, partly, they suffered off very well. They had the elections, they had the regular, you know, democratic, free elections. And then what came into power really did not have the intention of maintaining that freedom. What came to power were the Islamists, the radicals, the Takfiris, and they had no interest in maintaining free elections or maintaining stability in the country. What they did was they destroyed the armed forces, destroyed the police force in the country, the two major forces that maintain peace and security within the country and outside the country. Both were destroyed, and they were replaced with militias. They supported, they transferred huge amounts of funds and monies, close to $900, maybe $1 billion and more, to these militias, which we are fighting today. You know, undermined any form of strong central government. And it took another second revolution by the people to say, we don't want you anymore. We want you out of here.
What would you say about the role of what people have called external players? Here I'm talking about Qatar and Turkey on the one hand, and Egypt and the United Arab Emirates on the other.
Well, you know, here's the thing. The thing is Egypt has a lot to fear from these people. The Egypt went through its own revolution with these radicals. I'm really elated that Egypt was able to rid itself of these guys, because had it not, North Africa would have fallen to this radicalism that we're seeing today taking place in Iraq and in Syria. I'm very, very happy that Egypt's rid itself of those. And of course, Egypt has a direct interest in not having them re-emerging in Libya. If it does, I mean, it's going to destroy them too. It's their own security as far as Egypt is concerned. And yet, in spite of this, Egypt has not intervened militarily in Libya. That it supported Haftar and supported the Libyan army to fight them? Yes, I'd say so. The same thing with the Emirates. The Emirates is also facing a problem. They live in a rotten, bad neighborhood. And of course, Qatar is the major financer of these sectarians. Perhaps not the Qatari government per se, okay, even though there's some doubts on that. But there's certainly moneyed individuals within Qatar who have been supporting these sectarians from Tunisia, in Libya, even, believe it or not, even in Syria and Iraq.
Where do you see Libya heading in the near future?
Libya has to go through these rebirths. There is no way around that. What we're seeing today in Benghazi, you're seeing the army fighting its way through with these sectarians. They're pushing them back slowly, bit by bit. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be very, very difficult. It's going to work itself out, but it's going to take some time.
Mansour El-Kikia is a Libyan-American author, columnist, activist, and professor of political science at the University of Texas, San Antonio. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga. And in South Sudan, commuters and motorists in the capital, Juba, are grappling with an ongoing fuel shortage, which is pinching pockets and leaving fuel pumps bone dry. Long queues and even longer walks are the order of the day. VOA's fellow Michael Atit has the story.
Wani Michael is a South Sudanese who works for one of the many civil society organizations in Juba. Every morning, he drives to his office, but what was once a simple routine now makes Wani feel like a victim. Since the recent fuel shortage began, he must spend hours queuing at the petrol stations to fill his tank. On same days, he gets to the office as late as 10 or 11 a.m.
It's a kind of challenging. When you wake up in the morning, you start to brush your teeth, organizing, going for work. What comes into your mind is, how am I going to get to a place of work?
These days, hundreds of pedestrians who used to board commuters' buses and vans to go to work are now walking along Juba streets and roadways. Others scramble for a seat on a few commuters' vehicles that manage to secure fuel. The businesses most hard hit by the crisis is that of the taxis and operators of motorcycle transport, commonly known as boda bodas. Commuter taxi and boda boda services are the cheapest and the fastest means of transport used by the most people in Juba and in several states capitals of South Sudan. Here are some voices of commuters, drivers and boda boda operators explaining how the crisis affects them.
The fuel stations along the Jebel Road have no fuel in them. You see a fuel station, but when you go up to it, you find there is no fuel. Drivers used to go to a fuel station and get a full tank that would keep them going for 3 or 4 days. But now you can only get one jerrycan. And you have to go back again tomorrow and stand in the queue to get fuel. There is fuel outside the petrol stations, but it's very expensive. So we, the drivers, decided to increase the bus fare. We used to charge our passengers 2 South Sudanese pounds, but we decided to start charging them £3 instead. A jerrycan of diesel is 200 or 220 South Sudanese pounds on the black market. For petrol, a liter is 50 South Sudanese pounds.
Before the fuel crisis hit, a liter of petrol cost 6 South Sudanese pounds, and a jerrycan, which holds 20 liters, cost 120 South Sudanese pounds. Last month, officials with the Minister of Petroleum, Mining and Industry tried to explain the sources of the fuel shortages. They said there had been delays in the delivery of a letter credit to Qatar National Bank, or QNB, which would facilitate payments for fuel imports in Kenya to South Sudan. They also identified technical breakdown in Eldoret town of Western Kenya, where fuel to South Sudan is being imported from. And they said government efforts to crack down on illegal clearance agents at Nimule Customs Office have also contributed to the problem. But South Sudanese government spokesperson Michael McQuay says the main source of the delay is entirely within South Sudan.
What brought about all these technicalities is simply because of there have been a lot of clearing agents, and these clearing agents have been reduced, and as such the number decreased and they could not deliver in time.
Back on the streets of Juba, official explanations are no use to people struggling to make a living each day. Ofono Robert is a boda boda operator at Konyo Konyo Market in Juba.
We buy the black market, another one we mix with the water. If you're powering the motorcycle, no working.
Ibra Simon is another boda boda operator. He says the shortage has forced him to push hard for clients, but sometimes the results are not worth the effort.
Our work has become very hard because fuel is very expensive.
Despite government increased effort to sort out the problem, it is now almost a month since the fuel shortage began. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Washington.
And this is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, November 9th. Let's start off with athletics. The 32nd edition of the Athens Marathon, the authentic marathon, was a reminder of the historic basis of marathon running. As ever, African runners took part in strength. Andy Edwards reports from Athens on the outcome.
Marathon fans around the world have been waiting 10 years for the course record on the notoriously tough Athens course to be broken, and at last, that day has arrived. Felix Candy, hardly a big name on the road running circuit until today, won the men's title in 2:10:37, which was 18 seconds faster than it took the Italian Stefano Baldini to win the Olympic title in 2004. His performance overshadowed a fine contest in the women's race, where Naomi Mayo overhauled her fellow Kenyan and last year's winner Joan Rotich with just over 2 kilometres remaining. The expected big group in the men's race went through halfway in 65 minutes 52, suggesting that the event record was under pressure, but few suspected that the course record would also be threatened. With just over 7 kilometres remaining, the title appeared to be a duel between Felix Candy and Raymond Bett, both from Kenya. The latter had already won the Athens title twice, and in even years, so the omens seemed to be in Raymond Bett's favour. Felix Candy had other ideas. Although he went into the race with a personal best of 2 hours 16, he was running much faster than that and full of confidence. Once the final hill had been climbed in company with Raymond Bett, he pulled away to put increasing distance between himself and the double Athens champion. Even more impressively, Felix Candy ran into the Panathinaikum Stadium to see the clock showing 2 hours, 10 minutes and 37 seconds, the fastest any man has run the hilly Athens course. Raymond Bett was almost 2 minutes behind, and Joseph Achobe completed the Kenyan clean sweep in third place. The lead in the women's race changed hands decisively, with 2 kilometres left. Until then, Joan Rotich, despite feeling an injury, had thought she was on course to retain her title. Her fellow Kenyan Naomi Mayo caught her at 40 kilometres and surged to victory by 23 seconds. Mayo won in 2 hours 41 and 6 seconds. Lina Churchia finished third to ensure Kenya dominated the podium in both races. The Athens Marathon is never easy, given its undulating nature and what are often the late summer conditions, with temperatures on this occasion rising to the mid-20s centigrade for the competitors. All the more impressive, then, that Felix Candy should break the course record and inspire a Kenyan celebration, when recent headlines have cast a shadow over one of the world's top distance-running nations. That's the news from Athens, Segun. Now back to you in Lagos.
Congratulations to Candy, and many thanks to Andy. After the race, Andy spoke with Candy, the men's champion and the new Athens Marathon course record holder.
Candy, you've run inside 2:11. That's time to be confirmed, but a wonderful performance. Did you feel strong all the way?
Yeah, I feel strong. At the start first, my body did not respond well. I was fighting. Then as we passed the halfway, I felt like my body has responded well. And I thought maybe I'll try to run a top three. But I was surprised at the 35th kilometer when I dropped two guys. So I tried to fight. I knew that if I maintain the base, maybe I will win the race.
Raymond Bett was your closest challenger, and he's won it twice before. Were you worried about him? Because you went away from him after about 35 kilometers.
Yeah, actually, for me, I was not afraid of him. As I just know, the best winner win. And if I get the second position or the first, we are coming from one place. I could have been happy also if you just won.
Everyone says this Athens course is so hard. It's up and down. It's really tough. What did you think of it?
As we were traveling to the starting line, I was so worried a little bit because I was seeing the bus going downhill. So no flat, no any way I can run fast. I was just wondering if I can maintain the pace of 3 or 4, 3 or 5 that the race organizer told us to maintain.
Well, we're talking in this Panathinaikon Stadium.
which was used for the first modern games in 1896. What's it feel like running into this stadium and crossing the line as the Athens champion?
I feel very happy that I have come around here. It's a great pleasure for me. Great privilege.
Felix Candy, winner of the Athens Marathon, the authentic marathon in 2014. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Andy also spoke with Naomi Mayu of Kenya, who beat last year's women's champion Joan Rotich by 23 seconds to win the Athens Marathon title.
That looked a very tough race, Naomi.
Yeah. The race was very nice. We started well. We came together till 32 kilometers. We came as a group of three. Then when we were in that five, I tried to push a little. I won, I'm the winner.
You're just outside your own personal best, but given the conditions, I think the temperature in the stadium is around 25 degrees centigrade. Yeah. Was that your hardest marathon?
Yeah, it was. It is the hardest marathon. Yeah.
Joanne Rotich has won the race last year. Were you afraid of her?
Yeah. No. I was prepared to fight with him. With her.
Winning Athens, does this inspire you to go on and do better?
Yeah.
Well done, Naomi Mayo, the women's champion in the Athens Marathon. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Again, many thanks to Andy for the interviews. Turning to football news, the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations is in trouble. To save the tournament, organizer African Soccer's governing body, CAF, must find a replacement after Morocco rejected an ultimatum to go ahead with the event in January. Morocco has reiterated its stand not to host the tournament early next year due to fears over the spread of the Ebola virus. CAF refused to entertain a change of dates and must now find an alternate host as quickly as possible or face cancelling the tournament at great financial cost. CAF has approached other African countries to step in as an emergency replacement, but has so far received no public expressions of support. The continental governing body is due to meet in Cairo, Egypt on Tuesday to decide on the next course of action. We will not be making any statements until after the meeting makes a final decision, CAF media director Junior Binyan said. The continental ruling body had given Morocco until Saturday to give a firm response on whether it will stage the event. But on that day, Morocco's sports minister Mohamed Ouzine merely restated the fear that the tournament could spread Ebola. This decision is motivated mainly by the medical risks that will put this virus on the health of our fellow Africans, the minister said in a statement. Morocco is concerned that supporters from West Africa converging on the country for the tournament could bring with them the deadly virus and put at risk its important tourist industry. Parts of West Africa are facing the worst Ebola epidemic since the virus was identified in 1976, and cases have reached as far as the United States and Spain. Morocco says it could host the tournament later, recalling that CAF had back-to-back Nations Cup in 2012 and 2013, when it switched from hosting the event from even to odd years, and could reverse the process in 2016 and 2017. CAF, which garners the majority of its revenue from the tournament's television and marketing rights, has cited a packed calendar for its refusal to consider a June date or move to early 2016. Finally, Nigeria will host five-time world champion Brazil in a high-profile friendly on March 29th at a new stadium that was opened on Friday in the country's southern Akwa Ibom state. Nigeria hosted Brazil in 2003 in the capital city of Abuja, with Brazil winning 3-0. The new 30,000 capacity stadium will be used for Nigeria's final 2015 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying match against South Africa on November 19th. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll hook up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. I'm a
Yeah.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Owing to the importance attached to the United States as the beacon of a vibrant and functioning democratic state, it is of the utmost significance that Africans pay special attention to what transpired during the midterm elections in the United States for all members of the House of Representatives and one-third of the Senate. The election, which was held last week, was a resounding defeat for the Democratic Party, with the substantial gains of the Republican Party in the House and the Senate, there is a serious threat to the capacity of President Barack Obama to accomplish much in the remaining 2 years of his administration. However, it is useful to go beyond the bare results of the election to have a clear and better understanding and appreciation of what should expect in the coming months. First of all, despite the exaggerated claims by some, the results are not all that spectacular in terms of the historical record. It is very common that in the sixth year of any two-term presidents, that the opposition party usually gain between 14 to 25 seats in the House of Representatives and roughly 7 seats in the Senate. This midterm election, the Democratic Party lost 14 seats in the House and about 7 seats in the Senate. Of the utmost importance is the fact that was stressed by President Barack Obama in his press conference, but poo-pooed by the so-called Beltway media. The president said he had heard from the one-third that voted and also from the two-thirds that did not vote in the election. This is the same turnout for the midterm elections in 2010 when the Republican Party captured the majority in the House of Representatives. What is most baffling is the apparent lack of concern of the American political class for such a low turnout. How can one pretend that 36% of the voters are speaking on behalf of the entire American people? Yet, some politicians are in the habit of saying, quote, the result speaks for the American people. The better thing to say is the results spoke for the voters. In the recent European parliamentary elections, it was also a very low turnout for the voters. Just imagine what the international media would say if in Zimbabwe, President Robert Mugabe should sweep the polls in a turnout of about 36%. They might say he has no mandate to govern. The question is, are we prepared to change it, or are we actually drifting to a form of plutocracy in the Western world? It should be borne in mind that in areas of Africa, Latin America, and Asia, the turnout is usually very high. And it is better for democracy if many people participate in the elections. Strangely, in the United States, instead of making special efforts to raise the voting turnout, some politicians prefer to suppress the votes by such laws as voter identification. The midterm election was also conducted in terms of the Senate in those states where President Obama lost in 2012 substantially. So the fact that the Democrats lost in those states now is of no surprise. President Obama, when he appeared before the press, many of the correspondents appeared to expect him to hoist the white flag of surrender. He did not do that because he understood what has happened. In the coming months, and maybe for the last 2 years, keen and experienced observers believe that not much will happen. The gridlock will continue, and there is no prospects that the conservatives in the House will change their position. Stay tuned and watch what's happening in the U.S. Congress. I thank you.
And that was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Odette Fraser, Sports Editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Brian McCullier, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as always, as the elders say, a wise person who knows proverbs reconciles difficult ties. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to strengthening ties with the nations of Africa, one of the world's most dynamic and fastest-growing regions. The effort includes a number of programs and initiatives to spur economic growth and underscore America's commitment to Africa's security, democratic development, and economic growth. Tanzania is the second largest economy in East Africa, and with its key location and natural resources, it has the potential for continued growth. Our nation is one of its top five foreign investors, with roughly $950 million a year focused there. President Jakaya Kikwete spoke to U.S. investors and businessmen at an African investment forum held in Washington during the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in August. In October, two U.S. delegations traveled to Tanzania to promote further business development between our two nations. Led by Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs David Duckenfield, a group of U.S. investors, entrepreneurs, and philanthropists toured the country to explore investment and trade opportunities with Tanzanian companies and startups. The group, organized under the U.S. State Department's Partnership Opportunity Delegation Initiative, traveled to Dar es Salaam, Bagamoyo, and Zanzibar and discussed potential projects and partnerships with private sector leaders. They also visited with local communities, manufacturers, and small business owners. Also the same month, U.S. Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew toured the port of Dar es Salaam to discuss investments in Tanzanian infrastructure projects such as ports, roads, and rail links. These are critical for growth both in Tanzania and throughout the region. Secretary Liu also visited an energy infrastructure site. Inadequate infrastructure has made Tanzania a high-cost business area, investors say. Improvements in port, rail, and road systems could double intra-regional trade in the East African community and boost EAC exports to the U.S. by 40%. U.S. government support for transport and energy infrastructure are key elements to the Trade Africa and Power Africa initiatives launched by President Obama last year. Such U.S. programs are designed to find solutions to challenges in Africa and our partner nations around the world through facilitating effective public-private partnerships.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.